Welcome to this week's episode of the First Moves podcast. This week we're talking to Mike Verhill, CEO of Solaris, a company that's revolutionizing mental health care by using VR to enhance treatment protocols. If you want to listen to the insane story of Mike leaving a dream job to now finding success with Solaris, listen to this episode. It's been one of the most valuable conversations that we've had so far on the podcast, and we hope you'll enjoy it just as much as we did. Thank you very much.
Mike, welcome to the show. First question we have for you is, could you please introduce yourself and share the journey that led to the founding of Solaris?
Well, hey guys, nice to be here. My name is indeed Mike Verhill. I'm the current CEO of Solaris. And the story of how Solaris came to be is quite an extensive one, actually. To follow my own personal track, I had a really nice job before this job. I was the innovation product manager at KPN. Amazing job, a lot of things to do, a nice salary, a nice lease car, a nice apartment. Everything was fine and daisy. Until on one Sunday morning, I woke up and realized, what the hell am I doing? Some people have this feeling when they're like 40 and it's called a midlife crisis. I think I was 27 or 28 at the time, so I really hope it was not a midlife crisis, but it was a quarter life crisis. Anyway, I woke up and had this realization, I'm not adding value to this world. And it sounds like a very, very modern thing to say, but if you have to go to the office and you only realize I'm doing this for money, it's not going to be a fun life. So I decided then and there, I'm going to do something else. I think a week later, a good friend of mine, Christoph, called me with the idea of Solaris. Like, hey, Mike, I have a great idea. He told it to me, and we decided to start the company. Now, the idea was actually pretty simple. In the mental healthcare sector, there is a tremendous problem going on at the moment. If you open a random newspaper, you will probably see it. Large waiting times, money shortages, high expenses, et cetera, et cetera. And every year it seems to be getting worse. He thought, what if we could automate this? What if we find a way of giving these therapy sessions, which now a therapist has to do always in person? This was pre-COVID, by the way, so online therapy was not a thing. How would it be if we could automate these therapy sessions in such a way that a piece of software could conduct them? Because then you have the situation that you would go to a therapist, you have one or two in private sessions, then you would take the software home, do a session there by yourself, and when you get back, you're way further in your progress of having this treatment. We thought it was a great idea, and that's how the whole thing was born and created. We also used VR for that, the headsets, the goggles, you probably know them, you had them on your heads at one time of your life, I hope. Exactly. And the reason for that is we noticed that if somebody has a VR headset on their face, they are completely, engulfed? Immersed, that's the right word indeed. Immersed in the experience. There is no distraction. And we did some testing with like 2D screens and VR. And apparently if you use a 2D screen like a laptop and you have the software running on there, the therapy session, people get distracted. People don't really want to dive into it. With VR, no distraction, you can treat properly. So that's basically the origin story of Solaris. We also then registered for Y Combinator, and we managed to actually get in there. So the first 3 or 4 months of Solaris was in Silicon Valley under Y Combinator. I see Sebastian looking at me very like, wow.
Yeah, that's a big thing to get into the Y Combinator like that. It's quite difficult for non-American companies to get into it as well.
It is pretty difficult indeed. But not impossible.
No.
We were, I think, the 6th Dutch company ever to join them, or the 5th or something. After us, multiple other companies have also joined. The biggest hurdle you have to take is filling in the form. Because a lot of people think, I'm not going to fill in this form because it's so difficult, it's so hard, I'm never getting in. So they just skip on it. I mean, so my recommendation, just fill it in. Even the filling in of the form will give you that much experience that you learn a lot of things because they ask very critical questions.
Yeah. I think, I mean, there's different ways to look at it. I think just taking the first shot is always very important. Mm-hmm. And people often think you don't have a chance, but you often do. I have many friends and we have the same mindset. And it's surprising where you end up very, very quickly. But I'm actually curious. So you talked about your friend,
Christoph,
coming to you with the idea. You then saying, hey, that sounds like a very interesting proposition. But what about this intersection between technology and mental health actually pulled you in that was motivating enough for mm-hmm. you on a personal front, about that impact front that you were lacking at KPN mm-hmm. to then go and pursue?
Yeah, very good point indeed. For me, in my personal atmosphere, I had some very close friends who were, I'm not going to call it suffering, but difficulties with mental health. Very good friend of mine, he was depressed. And everybody knew that except for him. Now, after a while, he finally took the step to go to a GP and mentioned like, hey, I'm having difficulties with motivation, with getting out of bed. I feel down all the time. GP said, we're going to like send you to a therapist. Went to the therapist, and the first thing there was that you can start treatment in 6 months' time. And for me, that was such an alien concept. Like, wait, we know how to help you. We have the therapy ready for that. We know exactly what to do. But because of some aspect money-wise and personnel-wise, we cannot treat you, so you have to wait for 6 months. Now, those 6 months are going to be a nightmare then. And you will see people, like, slowly declining even worse. That one and a couple of very other close friends and family members, I saw this happening for me, the reason to say, hey, this field is so interesting for me. I have zero experience in it because, as I mentioned before we started the recording, I studied economics. So the mental healthcare sector is not the most logical place to be then. Was for me the inspiration, hey, I'm going to make a change here. I'm going to learn all of this and start up Solaris.
And then what about the first move? Because I think there's more between the idea coming on your plate mm-hmm. and then the Y Combinator form. Where do you actually then start?
Yeah, the starting is the mental switch you make. You have two aspects. You have first the mental block of deciding I'm going all in on this. And then the first time you run into trouble. Because mm-hmm. everybody can say, I'm going to start a company, I'm going to do this. And for me, the first mental switch I made was the decision to quit my job, get in the airplane, throw everything away ahead, and go to America. And a lot of people told me, Mike, you are completely crazy. What the hell are you doing? You have an awesome career. You're making a lot of money. In 10 years' time, you're going to be some senior manager there. What are you doing? And for me, it was a very nice encounter I had with my then manager. Because I went to her and I said, I have to talk to you because I'm quitting my job. The first thing she did was look at me and ask, like, Mike, what the hell? Why are you going? And are you going to the competition? Are you going to Zego? And she was actually getting quite pissed. And I said, no, this is a situation. I got invited to join the company, et cetera, go to America. And she looks at me and says, Mike, if you had told me this story and you would have mentioned that you were not going, I would have fired you so that you would have to go. This is like life handing you on a silver platter a chance. You have to take it and run with it. So that was one of the first mental switches I had. The second one was when we returned in Holland. And we heard no so many times. Because we had this brilliant concept and we thought, oh, the market is going to love this. We're going to like automate EMDR therapy because that was our first therapy. And every single therapist looked at me and said, no, we're not doing this. This is. Do you have proof? No. Do you have like other customers? No. Then of course, no, get out. And that's when you need to have the mindset, I'm going to keep going, I'm going to keep pushing this, even though the world thinks I'm a bit crazy.
So talking more about that switch from working for a big company, a big organization like KPN, and then going to a much smaller team of Solaris. How was that switch for you?
Liberating. I'm not going to bash the big corporates because on one hand, they're very nice companies and they work the way they work because they have to do that. You cannot go completely freelance there and do whatever you want on a daily basis. There needs to be structure, processes. But the downside of that is it's very slow. It's not exciting. And if you go to a very small company where you have limited resources, limited time, basically everything is limited, but the one thing you have is the own freedom. You can decide what to do. It is so liberating. It's like taking fate into your own hands and deciding this is going to be my path. It's also scary as hell.
Yeah, because all of a sudden it all falls on you.
Exactly. And then you look at the bank account and you see the bank account going down every month. Yeah. And that's when you have some really bad experiences. I mean, for myself, when I was working at KPN, I had a nice savings account. I burned it all for Solaris. We went to Silicon Valley, we got an investment there, we went back again, and all of a sudden the money is gone, and you have no new investment. And the money coming in was not that much, so you had to make a decision. Am I going to fire my people and then continue, or am I just going to go into debt myself, take all the loans that I could get, and also live back in a shitty place? Because I went from fancy apartment in The Hague to shitty student room in Maastricht again, living on like noodles and soup and stuff like that just to come by, because I was believing in the part, this can become something big.
And I mean, I think it did become something, absolutely.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, you have more than 5,500 therapists that are currently using Solaris products. Mm-hmm. More than 850 organizations that are using it, mm-hmm. and more than 75,000 sessions being completed.
Yeah.
And also covering a really wide variety of different tools and kinds of therapy, and also now Solaris Relax from 4 months ago. Mm-hmm. So there has been this really big pickup in momentum. The simple question, but maybe a difficult answer, is how did you get from being in a student room eating noodles to the point where you are today?
It is a simple question if you ask it like that. Let me take you a bit through the process of what happened on the vision part of Solaris. We decided very early on that if we wanted to be successful, a therapist would not have really upscale our products if we only had one solution. So we decided we need to have multiple solutions. The problem is we had such a small development team, like one or two people, that was it in the beginning. How can you maintain five different products? And under those products, you also have diversions of that. It's almost not possible. Our investors also told us, don't do this. Please just go for one solution, make it very successful, and then expand. And we decided we're going to be stubborn. This is my vision. I believe that we need to build this platform. We did this, and it cost me like 10 years of my life, at least. I mean, these wrinkles were not there before. Anyway, what happened? Our competition, they did decide we're going to do one solution and stick to that. And I think the inflection point came around 2.5 years ago, when therapists and organizations realized, wait a second, these guys from Solaris have a whole bunch of collections of solutions, and each individual one of them is just as good as these other people who charge the same amount of money for one solution. And that's when we saw the changing, like, hey, we're upscaling. So that's one part. On the other part, of course, you have to build your team. And that's, I think, even more important than the tech you're building. Surround yourself with smart people, with people who know it better than you do. Because if I would hire a marketing manager, that person needs to be an expert and better at marketing than I am. Same for a sales manager, same for a developer. Okay, developer is really easy because I cannot write code. Maybe if this, then that, but that's kind of stops there. So you had a tech vision, you need to have your vision, like where am I going in 5 years' time? And of course, the team building aspect.
Something that I always found quite difficult, and I think a lot of people do, mm-hmm. is holding on and having faith in that vision that you set for yourself. Because you don't want to be insane, where the world is shouting no at you all the time for a very long time, mm-hmm. and you hold on to it at a big cost. But on the other hand, there's a certain kind of return that you can get from being so stubborn and being able to kind of redefine maybe what people expected or wanted. Mm-hmm. So how do you walk that line, and how did you hold on to that vision of Solaris?
It's a very good question, because on one hand, you need to be a bit stubborn, like you say. You need to have your vision, and people will tell you, no, it's not going to work. Because people also kind of want you to fail, but that's a whole different discussion. At the same time, if your idea really is crazy and it will never work, then until what point do you have to hold on to your vision? When do you know you're wrong? And I thought about this quite often in the past and also at the moment, because now it seems like I took the right choice. I made the right decision to keep going. Yeah, for me, it was always the thing, as long as I still believe that I can make it in a realistic way, I'm going to go for it. Do I have any advice or an in-depth point about how to say, like, no, it's enough? I don't know. Because I also know that, I forgot the name of the company, I could have sworn it was Airbnb. They almost went bankrupt once, as in completely bankrupt. And I think it was either them or another, a different famous company who actually went to the casino with the money they had left and put it all on black. Not sure if it's Airbnb. I'm going to Google this for you guys. Because they were so convinced it's going to work, we need to do this, so we're going to take this extreme risk we have just to be able to make it. And yeah, that's something you have to do once in a while. I do not recommend, by the way, going to the casino with your investor money. Let's not do that. If you want a lawsuit, that's how you get a lawsuit.
But indeed, maybe a 50-50 shot seems better than the position you were in. So why the hell not?
Exactly.
Maybe that was their frame.
That was the frame they had, indeed. The frame was like, hey, either we're going to go bankrupt for sure, or we're going to gamble on this and perhaps get out of it again.
Maybe to go back to how you guys built the team around Solaris. So I can imagine that you've gotten this Y Combinator. It's sexy. So there's a lot of people who would like to come join. But how do you actually get critical in selection of the team members who want to join, if that's even the case, that there are like a lot of people who line up for that?
It will surprise you how little people in Holland actually know about Y Combinator, especially employees, entrepreneurs. They all know it. That those are entrepreneurs for a reason, they're not going to work for you. That's the whole different point. The second part of the question, how do you select the right people? That's a very, very difficult one. I think the thing which stuck most to me from all the lessons we learned at Y Combinator, it's very simple. Hire slow, fire fast. Take a long time in evaluating the person who's going to work for you. Make sure they're aligned to your vision and your mission. Trust them, that's a very important one, because if you do not trust the person, do not hire him. And if at any point that trust is breached, out. And that sucks, because we also had to make some decisions, which I'm not going to say gave me nightmares, but there was a point we had to fire somebody who was, he just became a dad of his fourth child, I believe. And then you have to say, sorry, I have to let you go because you're not doing it right. And some people told me, like, Mike, that's so mean, you cannot do this. But for me, it was a very, very simple decision. Either he has to go, or I bring my entire company in danger, and perhaps I have to fire then 20 people. So that's an easy choice. But if you can ever tell me how to find the right people, please tell me. Because for me, it's based upon trust, vision, and motivation. Well, let's elaborate on that one, by the way. I found that especially in the beginning phases, and still in the moment we are now, motivation counts for a lot. If you have a person coming in and is completely enthusiastic but lacks a certain amount of skills, it's easier to train him in those skills than it is to have some senior who's like, meh, I don't really care.
I mean, I think that's crucial also because, I mean, we are both students and we don't have, you know, per se money to pay a lot of people on our teams or things like this, so... At least for me, I also knew that a lot of people who we'd bring on the team were inexperienced or they just wanted to try something. And so for that, attitude over skills, because the attitude could close any gap in the skills if you put them in the right place and you give them the right tools. And it's, I mean, I never applied it to the larger corporate frame because you think you can fill anything with money maybe or things like this. But I guess attitude counts. I mean, it counts everywhere. I think it speaks for itself, but I never applied that frame. So. It's an interesting perspective that we've aligned on. I think I want to zoom in a bit more on Solaris itself. So you're working in the mental health sector. You started with the intention of kind of shortening these waiting times from both personal experience and seeing this kind of information in your environment. But can you maybe explain kind of what the core mission behind the company boils down to?
Company mission is actually very simple if you want to put it out in the open. We want to provide affordable mental health care to everybody in the world, regardless of time, place, or money. So even if you're poor, you should be able to get this kind of therapy. If you are located in Peru, for example, you should have access to proper mental health care. That's our whole vision, like, hey, we want to go there. We think we can achieve that by creating this kind of therapy solutions, which automate a part of the therapy. We still believe that we need a therapist to guide the whole process. But in our vision, that person is mainly going to be, I'm not going to say coach, because then a lot of people will hate me for that. Therapists don't want to be called coaches. More of a director of your mental health. The person looks you, says, okay, you have these and these issues. We're going to help you. And for that, we have these and these and these solutions. And hopefully those will be Psylaris solutions so that we can then provide trauma treatment, anxiety treatment, depression treatment, etc. Something the patient can then do by himself at home when needed.
So how do the treatments actually work? Because you mentioned VR as well, that is a component of it. Mm-hmm. Is it just a component, or is it really based on the VR only with a program that runs inside of it?
I shouldn't elaborate on this because the viewers else have no idea what I'm talking about. What we do, we take existing treatments, such as the anxiety treatments, cognitive behavioral therapy, EMDR, et cetera, et cetera. We take those and analyze them. Like, how is this being conducted normally in a normal face-to-face session? The next step is then thinking about how can we put this protocol exactly in an automated piece of software so that you talk or you interact with a therapist. I'm going to say therapist with air quotations here, because you're actually talking or interacting with a algorithm. Then we, as the final step, we put that in the VR headsets because of the immersion and no distraction, and people really can engage there. And then you have an environment, which is a neutral environment. So you don't see your anxiety, you don't see your fears, everything like that. You hear a voice talking to you, no avatar, because if you have an avatar there, you might come into the uncanny valley. You don't want that. And that person will guide you through your session. You then have to give selections. And we do that now with a control pointer. You just make your choices. And based upon your choices, which are conscious but also unconscious, for example, the conscious choice is pressing the button, saying it's a 4, it's a 5, I have troubles with this. But an unconscious choice is something like, how long does it take me to press the button? Where am I looking in the VR headset? What am I doing? And because we had thousands and thousands of sessions now, we know when a certain behavioral pattern occurs in the headsets, we're going to change the algorithm then so that the therapy session flows in a certain way, which is most helpful for that patient. So it's not an AI, because an AI would do this completely live and it's a bit of a black box. But we did have a very large part with the whole data pool, analyzing our data and changing the algorithm for that. But what the patient sees is VR headset goes on. You sit in a neutral environment. That can be an apartment. That can be nature. That can be a gray box, whatever you want. And you have a therapist talking to you. And it's like a natural voice. And you really feel, I'm talking to a therapist. And he's helping me with this protocol. Be that EMDR. Be that CBT in the near future. And with exposure, that's an anxiety treatment. There you have, for example, videos of the fears you have. For example, if you would have a fear of, let's keep it nice and fluffy, Dutch birthday parties. Because I have that fear.
You mean sitting around in a circle all together, just talking endlessly?
Exactly that. You sit in a circle and one person can talk and the rest has to sit there with their piece of cake and yay.
Yeah. Relatable fear.
Yeah. Fun fact, a lot of people actually have this fear. It's the social anxiety. They don't want to go there because then people look at them. So what we did, we have a whole VR camera crew. They went to a house. We hired a bunch of actors. They sat around in a circle and they were interacting like that. Now, what can you do with this kind of therapy? Normally, for anxiety, you have something called imaginary exposure. Mm-hmm. That means the patient has to think about their fear. So we have to think about sitting in that circle. And if you have a really big fear of that, even that is difficult. And that then develops to the final point, in vivo exposure, that you actually have to go to a party and sit there and participate. The problem with that is what we saw in our treatment. A lot of people can do the imaginary part, but they kind of fail on the in vivo. They don't do it. They don't go there. With the VR headsets, you have an in-between solution. It's not as scary as being there in real life. But considering the immersion you have, it's so intense that it's much more than the imaginary exposure. So that's also one of our solutions. And then depending on the therapy we offer, we always customize the therapy for that.
So I have a trauma. I'm scared of something. I have a fear for something. Mm-hmm. I go to a therapist. Would it then work that I have a session with the therapist first, then I get a VR headset back home with me? Mm-hmm. And then once I am done with X amount of treatments or I don't have that fear anymore, then I give the headset back? Or mm-hmm. do I go directly to you and buy it from you?
No, you always go to a therapist.
Okay.
The reason for that is we as Psalaris and also the patient themselves cannot evaluate what they have.
Yeah.
Sometimes people think they have an anxiety for something, but there might be a trauma below it. And it's quite often in the world society we live in, a lot of people have traumas they don't know about. Could be sexual abuse from the past, could be your parents fighting with each other, which you really like put away in your brain. And when you start treatment, those things might pop up. That's the reason we say you always go to the therapist. That's a specialist. We are a provider of these solutions. But for the rest, indeed, as you mentioned, you go to the therapist, you have your session, take the headset home, go back again, bring the headset with you.
Yeah, so you always go to the therapist to kind of avoid the self-diagnosing part of it, and then something goes wrong in the process of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
What I find incredibly interesting, because I was always curious, and well, I think we'll go more in depth on that later, is that by going through these protocols in an automated way, which allows it to be more affordable and scalable, mm-hmm. you might lose some of that reactivity of being able to read the person throughout the protocol. Mm-hmm. But you said that with the data that you're using, eye tracking, waiting times, I thought that was incredibly interesting because it's a way that you can really gauge these small subconscious signals or behaviors mm-hmm. to then adapt live, yeah. which, I mean, I didn't know that that's what you guys did, which I found mm-hmm. incredibly interesting. And also, I mean, I myself have gone through EMDR as well. And I was looking at the videos on your website before, and I could imagine that this immersive setting is incredibly valuable. I just mm-hmm. use like two lights in my hand or a stick that was waved in front of my face. Mm-hmm. But seeing the mock-up essentially on my 2D screen, I could imagine that it's actually very valuable to have it this way. Mm-hmm. And also exposure therapy, I think, is also very interesting. So I don't know where I was going with that. It was more of a compliment than anything else. But yeah, I think it's incredibly interesting.
To give a small addition on that one, you mentioned eye tracking. We don't have eye tracking, but we do envision where the patient is looking because you make a slight head adjustment there. Because we use relatively cheap hardware, because if we want to have the most expensive hardware, the price would shoot up. And we want to make it as most affordable as possible.
I think, mm-hmm. first of all, I mean, that's interesting. I just think of me playing racing video games where I'm turning my head when I'm turning the car in the game. But I think that there's, it speaks of this affordability element that you were speaking of, using cheaper hardware. But I can mm-hmm. imagine that there's more than just affordability when it comes to actually the difficulty in getting the mental health care system to adopt Psalaris. Mm-hmm. So what kind of hurdles have you guys been running into?
Oh boy.
Please expand.
Yeah, you have a while. In the beginning and still at the moment, it's difficult to believe. A lot of people, therapists, look at us and think this is not possible. You cannot create this because I as a therapist must be present to give a proper session. And the fun fact is we always thought that we needed to have these large RCT studies, random clinical trials, in order to prove this, that we can do it. That wasn't the case. We just needed more customers, and customers from large institutions saying like, hey, we use this and it works. Because in the beginning, in every single sales pitch we had, the question back was, have you already proven this scientifically? At the moment, nobody does that. By the way, we did prove it. It works, it functions, but nobody asks about it. Implementation is a very, very hard aspect. It's a completely new way of working. It's a new technology. So if you have, that's also the reason we choose this. And for two reasons, we pick this headset. One is affordability. The second one is ease of use. It has one button. It has a controller. You point and you click. My mom can use this. My mom is, well, I should say this right, 65. Yeah, 65, yes, I think. If my mom is watching this, I'm sorry. Anyway, it should be very easy to use, and still then you see that therapists will try to push it away because it's a new way of working. It is, bopping against it. And it's something you see in every single sector. Back in my time at KPN, if there's something new, people resist that. And that's something you have to overcome by proving them that it works, that it will make their job more fun and more engaging. And of course, provide to management the proper business case that it also helps them.
When you say this, that people are resistant in the beginning to adopt these kind of things, have you also had the problems that a psychologist or therapist says, I don't want to use this because of the fear that they're going to lose out on some of their sessions, which means they wouldn't get paid as much as they would normally with someone?
That's the big discussion we have now with the health insurance company. A couple of years ago, we changed in Holland the model for insurance. Back in the day, we had the DBC, I have no idea how to translate in English, but I'm going to call it method number one to get reimbursed in the mental health care sector. I'm going to oversimplify this, but it basically meant a patient comes in and at the beginning you evaluate, is this a light, medium or complex case? Based upon the label you put on him, you would get paid for X amount of sessions. For example, light would be 8 sessions, medium 15 sessions, hard 20 sessions. If you would succeed in treating the patient who is medium and would get reimbursed for 15 sessions in 10 sessions time, the health insurance company would say, good job, guys. Here is money for 15 sessions. Because there was an incentive to treat these people better and faster. Now, that system was heavily abused because, as you can imagine, the whole labeling part might not have been that okay. So we changed to a different system. Different system, and again, I'm oversimplifying here, comes down to you have a treatment for an hour, you get paid for an hour. Now, the problem kicks in with Solaris, because in the old model, we had a very, very good business case. You use the headset, you need less sessions, you can get more money, you can pay for a headset. Nowadays, people have to pay for a headset, but they still get paid for the sessions they actually conduct. And that's a problem, because if you have less sessions, then you have a problem. It is the case, though, that if you have less sessions, you get paid a little bit more per session than it would normally be the case. But still, it's a gigantic hurdle. So that's the reason we're now talking to all the health insurance companies in Holland. And we are this close to getting reimbursed. We are already partially reimbursed, but the whole full aspect is hopefully coming in 2025.
And that's also a long process, because I'm also in the conversation about the gloves that I have for mm-hmm. Unshackled with health insurances, and it's just a long process to get through and actually get this to go.
Yeah,
there's a lot of conversations to be had.
It's a lot of conversations, because in the beginning, when you're just starting, we were seen as, oh, there you have another startup trying to get reimbursed. They send us out in the woods with some assignments, we came back again, and they take you a little bit more serious, and you... Et cetera. At the moment, one of the biggest investor in Solaris at the moment is a health insurance company. So as you can imagine, we now have more direct conversations with them because we're aligned. Fun fact, one of the things we had in our agreement is that we are not allowed to charge ridiculous prices anymore. And the business case for that was, if by any chance you ever get a monopoly, which might be the case because a health insurance company is helping you with upscaling, you're not allowed to do a thing like America where they had the insulin price go like from $1 to $1,000. And I think that's a very good thing. Also not my idea behind it, because I want to make the whole healthcare affordable. But it's a nice thing that they also think of that when they invest in you.
It's protecting the consumer in that case as well.
Exactly. Yeah. It's protecting the consumer. It's protecting the Dutch healthcare system to make healthcare affordable for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Otherwise, it would just compound into being extremely expensive and completely unattainable. And I think it just speaks to hopefully a larger trend in more principled business as well, which is something that I'm always a big proponent of. But I'm curious, when it comes to the pieces of resistance that you faced, I think there's so much in things being new mm-hmm. that you can't control it, because it's very much a social understanding of a new technology that is practically inexistent, and that uncertainty breeds fear and therefore resistance. Mm-hmm. So when there's so little that you can control in that setting because it's simply somebody's belief about something, what have you guys tried to do to try and change the beliefs of people and actually increase the adoption?
Find champions. People out there who have the same belief you have and who do feel like, hey, I believe in this product and I see it working. Very early on in the beginning, we had one of these champions, Berno. He was the first customer we actually had. And he believed in the product. He truly saw the vision like, hey, Solaris is going to make this and this happen. And I'll stand behind these guys because I see it working. And instead of us speaking to our customers, we quite often said like, hey, if you want to talk to a customer, talk to Berno. He would then talk to them like, no, it's amazing. I use it every day. And that's when you take away the resistance. Because you as a company, you cannot do that. You get this, in Dutch, we call it, we from WC Eend. We say, Doc, how do you translate this, guys? Is there an English saying for that? It's like if you're a company and you say like, my company is the best. Yeah, nobody's exactly going to believe that.
Yeah. But I don't know if there's a direct, like a good translation for it. But I think it just loses its credibility because, yeah, of course, yeah, you profit off of it. So
exactly. Yeah. So in that sense, getting this resistance part away, find your champions and let them talk for you.
We spoke earlier on motivation being fundamental to you in terms of your employees. And so as a leader in a very innovative field with, like we were just speaking of, a lot of resistance, how do you actually keep your team motivated to stay ahead of the curve?
I think in that sense, we have a very big advantage that the team who is working at Solaris is already so incredibly motivated, because the people working for us are not the people who do that for the money. Now, of course, you need to be able to get a good paycheck, because if you, at the end of the day, you go home and you think, it's not enough, then you have a problem. People at Solaris work for us because of the mission, the vision. Everybody there either had an encounter with a psychologist himself, knows somebody who's very close. For example, one of my best employees, not called the best, one of my most oldest employees, joined Solaris because he was the second person who ever used Solaris. He was at a psychologist, had a PTSD, got the headset, and was like, wow, this needs to be out there. That needs to be out in the open to all the people in the market. So I'm going to call these guys and see if I can get a job with them. Now, that was unfortunately way too soon, but he stalked us for kind of like a year. And then we decided, okay, we're going to hire you. Let's go. Those are the kind of people who work for us. So in that sense, getting them motivated is not that hard, but keeping them motivated is difficult, of course. Because if you dive too much into the aspects of how much revenue is coming in, what is the tech we're developing, you lose contact with the market. So for me, what's a very important thing is to share with my team as often as I can the results we're booking. If we hear a story about somebody being able to go back to work again because they used the headset, share that. That's motivating. And of course, the traditional things such as have your company parties, have your nice fun things, and play with each other. It's not all that serious. Because if you come to the office and you have to sit there like tuck, 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 for 8 hours, nah, it's not going to work. Keep it fun.
We also talked about innovation within Solaris. So innovation comes a lot of times with trial and error. Mm-hmm. How many iterations of the product did you guys actually need to make before you reached the one that was like, that's the one that works, this is the one you can put in the market?
Ooh. I have no idea how many iterations exactly, but there were quite some loops indeed. I remember in the very first solution we had an avatar sitting there. So like a digital therapist. That person looked like a nightmare. Because in VR, back in the day, the first headset we used was a Samsung Gear. You had like this Samsung headset on with the telephone in there, a graphic processor of nothing. So you couldn't really create nice imaging. So the avatar was a nightmare. We really removed that one fast. And we also made multiple of these mistakes. as you mentioned, in our sector, you need to try things out and fail. Fail fast. One of my personal sayings I love doing, and I stole this from a different quote. If you're not embarrassed about your product when you launch it, you launch too late. Who was that from again?
I don't know, because I've heard so many of the mentors and the people we talk to, professors, say this as well. Yeah. So I don't know who is the original quote from, but it's very true.
I mean, it's the same as the other one with, if you feel like you're in control, you're not going fast enough.
Yeah. It's the nature of the game.
Yeah, exactly. I think, like, at least from my experience, I think indeed the embarrassment is a great thing for Disorder, the clothing brand. The first text-based designs I made in PowerPoint, just using normal words, saving it as an image, and then uploading that to my producer's website. Severely embarrassing looking back, but it worked. Let's put it this
you're
way.
You're ahead of the curve then.
Yeah.
It's the very first step you take, and 99% of the people just stay in this idea phase and never act upon it. So just go for it.
Exactly. I think they're scared of being embarrassed, which is it's a superpower not to be. I guess.
It's just, you have to be embarrassed. I mean, I'm still embarrassed quite often. I sit somewhere and think, should I know this? I have no clue.
Yeah. No, imposter syndrome is good, in my opinion, but that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So speaking on innovation, innovation is a synonym for fuck-ups, right? As we said, there's going to be embarrassment. So what has been a really big fuck-up, pardon my French listeners, for Solaris?
I have a very embarrassing story, and for the people who are very squeamish, you might want to tune out here. It involves like losing a toenail. back in the beginning again, we had a product and we knew a certain part of the product was not completely up to date with the protocol of EMDR at that moment. So we knew we had to make some changes to that. It was, as you mentioned, embarrassingly bad. It was like, ooh, we really need to change this. We went to a meeting somewhere in The Hague, I believe, to a large, large institution, very large. And we came there and we were expecting to have like one or two psychologists in the room who would then talk to us and we would like showcase it them and we might have bought it or not. We entered the room, 20 people, including their entire management board. And I was like, ooh, I'm getting a bit nervous here. We sat down, we had our talk, and everything went amazing, but they demanded that we put the solution on the screen and we went through it. So it goes through, and that moment comes there where you look at the screen and you know this is wrong. And you see everybody in the room looking at the image like, this is bad, this is not good, no. And when I am very cringy and embarrassed, my toenails, I curl them in the inside, like, At that moment, I did that, but unfortunately, apparently, one of my toenails got stuck in my shoe on the front end, and with the force I pulled backwards, I actually ripped it out. So I was sitting there in complete agony and pain, trying to like hold the conversation strong. I think I managed to do it. In the end, they also bought the product, because we said we're going to change this, no problem, okay, we saw that, no problem. It wasn't a big deal. But in my head, it was such a big deal that we went outside and I said to Christoph, I have to sit down because I think my foot is bleeding. And he looks at me like, what the hell, Mike? So then we said that was Amsterdam. We sat in Amsterdam on this little couch outside, bench, took my shoe off, and there was my toenail. Now, unfortunately, I did not save it because I should have definitely framed this thing.
I was going to say, I was like, please, like, put it around a necklace. It's gross, but like, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
So, and we had quite some of those embarrassing things happening in Solaris. And in the end, it's something I don't care about. Also, if somebody starts working for me on the very first day or even during the interview process, I will tell them at one point you're going to fuck up. It's going to be bad. You're going to cost me a lot of money, probably like 5, 10, 20K because you didn't pay attention. And that's fine. The only thing I ask from you is that you be open about it. You say like, hey, I messed up. That's my bad. Won't happen again. Then we can laugh about it. Because that's the open culture you need. There needs to be room for making mistakes. And it's a fun thing.
And that's also how you generate the trust within your employees. Because if there's the culture where people are scared to come forward with something like this, then you get the culture where people don't trust each other. And then you don't know what's actually going on within your own company.
Exactly. Yeah. It needs to be open. And if somebody messes up, indeed, just bring it out. We laugh about it and we continue to the next mistake.
Actually, there was a point that came up in my mind because we've spoken so much about this, the product side of Solaris. But I went down the list before of how many therapists use, how many organizations use your products. So there's also very much a sales and marketing element to your success. Mm-hmm. How did you guys tackle that problem and how did that unfold throughout the years?
In the beginning, we were quite... I'm not going to say aggressive, but outreaching. Like, you have to go to your customers. You have to, like, convince them that they need to buy your products. And after a while, we started noticing that this is not the way. Nobody is waiting for a salesperson to come by and go like, hey, we have this amazing product. You want it? So we changed our entire belief system into something where we wanted to understand the problem the therapist had. And we would start also saying no to customers. And as soon as you start doing that, then you get very interesting conversations. Like, I want to buy your products. Then you, why would you want to do this? What's your benefit? And if there was not a good conclusion, you would tell them, like, no, you do not want to. You don't want our product. And then you see something strange happening in the eyes of the customer. Like, is the salesperson not telling me I'm not getting it? Huh? Mm-hmm. And that started to speak around in the market. Like, hey, the guys from Solaris, they're actually... very chill. They really care about your organization, about the best you can get. And that's how it started boosting. People started coming to us. And at the same time, under promise, over deliver. That's the number one thing in this market. Make sure you're like over delivering. Somebody has expectations, overdo them. And those are things in the little details. If you also look at sales specifically, one of the things I learned, and it's also something I learned from a sales pitch, a sales course, follow up, follow up, follow up, and follow up. I think on average, the person actually starts buying the product after the sixth or seventh follow up. And a lot of entrepreneurs reach out once, maybe two times, and then they stop. So in that aspect, that was a thing. And for the rest, yeah, I mean, I can try to explain the entire marketing approach we had, but I don't think that's that interesting. It's at the moment we're in the luxury position that customers come to us. And I believe that's the reason because of the 7 years we had behind before this. Over-delivering, being the nice customer, the nice supplier, and understanding the problems your customer has. That's perhaps the most important thing.
I think that that's also something that I'm learning as time goes on is that I think a lot of people, they try to come up with these very reactive strategies towards growing a business. Mm-hmm. But really, if you hone in on a few simple principles like under-promise, over-deliver, yeah, or really trying to meet your client's needs, not just saying it, but actually doing it by telling them no when they don't need it, those are the things that really create the long-term success, not the short-term. How do I just make sure that this person says yes? Or how do I react to this little news article the best? Mm-hmm. If you don't have those principles, you're going to be reactive all over the place and you're not actually aligned towards the North Star, which won't carry you anywhere.
And that's so, yeah, all the way back to how do we get Solaris from start to where we are now? That's to have that vision. Like, hey, I want to go there. And for that, I need to have these and these and these principles according to me. And maybe those principles will have to change along the way. But at the moment, I'm going to act with these in the back of my mind. Mm. Because if I don't even have an identity as my company myself, what am I doing then?
I think then I have one last question before we go towards the closing. How do you define those principles?
You have a very good sit down with yourself. And also then your other founders, very important if you have other founders. And you have a long, long, long talk about this, probably with quite some beers. You get the one together and you just envision like, how do we get to this point? And it's not about a marketing plan. It's not about a sales approach. It's about, if we ever reach that end stage of the company, how do I want the market to see me? And also very important, which kind of person do I want to be? What can I do? Can I still look at myself in the mirror in the morning? Because all the way back to the beginning, at KPN, I had that moment. I mean, it was Sunday morning, you wake up and I couldn't stand the person in the mirror anymore. I was not part of myself. And that's something you need to have combined with the vision. If you have that, then you're ready to start on a crazy-ass adventure called having a startup. And most likely you will fail because you need a tremendous amount of luck because I'm not sitting here because I was the best entrepreneur in the world. Definitely not. I had quite some luck along the way. And any entrepreneur who will tell you that's not the case is lying.
So we've talked about Solaris from the beginning and until where you are today. Mm-hmm. And in this journey, what is the achievement that you're most proud of?
Yeah. I believe after 2 years or something, I sat down with a therapist to have a talk about how they use the product. And that person told me the story about how he used the VR headset with a client. And that client was not responding to normal EMDR, had no effect whatsoever, and as a last resort, they tried the VR headset. Now, that person couldn't come outside properly. That person couldn't live a life. And the patient itself mentioned, thanks to the VR headset, I am able to live my life again. And that's when you realize, hey, I'm sitting with my head in all these numbers, in finances, in marketing, in innovation, in developing, et cetera, et cetera. But we're actually saving lives here. Thanks to the things my company is doing, people out there are out in the open again, feeling better, feeling great, and living their lives to the fullest. And that's the reason I'm running this company, and I've been able to put mad hours in this and just keep going and live on no salary for a year once. It's not a problem, because in the end, you know, this is what I'm doing it for.
I think that's a wonderful, wonderful motivator to have. Mm-hmm. Especially when things go to shit.
Yeah.
But I think there's one thing that now we've looked where you are today, what you're most proud of, but what's next?
We're now active in Holland, Germany, Belgium, Luxembourg, Austria, Switzerland, and some customers here and there with our online products. We want to make this a worldwide thing. Now we're like mostly Europe-based. We want to make this a worldwide thing that we actually have this virtual therapist who will help people. This is just the beginning. I mean, yes, we're helping people. The product is amazing, but we have so many more ideas to provide even better healthcare. And with the foundation we have in Holland, I believe we can make that.
In honesty, I mean, we don't know each other that well, but from what you've told us today, I believe the same thing. So I'd be excited to see it in a few years' time.
I'll keep watching.
Yeah, will do. Will do.
So we have this closing tradition on the podcast where we ask our guests to bring an object of significant value for them in either their personal or professional life. Mm-hmm. What did you bring with you today?
When you asked this question, I thought about it quite a while, like what should I bring? And I had quite some ideas, but I bought something small. It's a little champagne bottle, champagne cork. Champagne cork?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That seems right. Yeah, okay. The champagne cork. And that's the one we popped when we had the very first investment in Holland. Mm. For us, that was a tremendous game changer because it was finally the confirmation that, hey, investors in Holland believe in this product. We're on the road to success now. And before we popped that bottle, we had a shit year. It was a nightmare. As I mentioned, customers saying no. There was no salary, no income. And even your biggest foundation you had was like kind of shaking, like, is this really a good idea? Now, when this investment came in, we got a bottle of champagne from them, a very good one also. We popped it. And for me, it stands for celebrating the fun parts in life. Because afterwards, we had so many more successes. But more importantly, we changed. We changed from a company with a grim outlook to a very positive one. And that's something I also want to give to all the listeners and viewers out there. Celebrate your successes. Have fun, even the little things. If it's your personal life, I mean, if you manage to score a goal on the football team, if you, I don't know what, if you score a pass for your exam, celebrate. Because if you're not going to do it, nobody's going to do it. Yeah. And that's my personal reminder that I should celebrate more often because I keep forgetting it, to be honest. We had two investments ago. It literally went like this. Hey, we have the investment. Yay, back to work. There was like no emotion whatsoever. And our German colleague who was doing the business in Germany looked at us and says, the two of you need to get out now and go drinking.
Yeah.
So yeah, celebrate your successes and have fun in life because else it's not going to be a fun part.
I think I can relate to that as well because we've had those conversations as well sometimes where you look at me and you're like, that's actually a victory. For me, it doesn't really seem like a victory because it's just
on the path to where I need to go. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at it from a third perspective, then actually it is quite a big step to go to where I want to go. So I also myself need to get better at celebrating the, I don't necessarily want to say the small things, but in a certain extent, celebrate the small things. Getting an investment is a huge thing. Mm-hmm. I'll definitely celebrate that when that happens as well for us.
I mean, yeah, for me, it's also a massive thing where you just have extremely high standards. And so when you tick a box on the path to achieving that standard, it's more relief, at least that's how I experienced it, than a mm-hmm. celebration. So I'm like, oh, thank God we got the investment. Chill. But not, yes, we did it. You know? I think it's maybe not an illness, but something that many entrepreneurs deal with, because it's another thing almost on the to-do list that we need to get there.
So. It's, as an entrepreneur, you have the end goal in mind constantly. Yeah. You want to go to your vision. And like you mentioned, Sebastian, it's just a small, like, okay, we have this check now, and we can continue the next one. Well, actually, if you zoom out, it's a massive win.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Mike, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, guys. It was a blast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Glad you enjoyed. I'm sure we did too, and the listeners did as well. Thanks a lot. Yes.
Thank you very much for listening to that episode of First Moves. If you want to connect with our guests personally, make sure to follow us on LinkedIn at First Moves. We also have an Instagram called First Moves Podcast. And lastly, if you could take a moment to leave a review, it helps us make the show better for you, but also helps us get even better and more insightful guests over the long run. Thank you very much, and have a great day.